Jamie, does your tattoo still hurt?
No, it doesn't. It's great. It's all healed up and I love it.
Guys, I was so tempted when I saw Jamie. He came over at Christmas time and he presented us with his brand new, beautiful Gonzo as Charles Dickens tattoo. And I was just, because he was like, oh, it hurts the whole time during dinner, during gifts, having drinks afterwards. The whole time, Jamie's just like, oh, it hurts. My arm hurts so much. For the record,
I was using that baby voice because I think it's funny. And it did. It hurt.
It hurt. It hurt so much.
My arm hurts.
But I just really wanted to just like slap him on the forearm so much. But then I was told.
And to be clear, 10 years ago, Scott absolutely would have slapped my arm.
I think
done
less than
damage
that
to the tattoo.
Well, that's the only reason. I didn't want to ruin your investment.
Dick.
But pain I would have gladly inflicted upon you.
Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about wine and movies.
God damn it, Jamie. It's a podcast about movies and wine. Did you change the intro back? Did you changed it back and you didn't think I was going to notice, you sneaky fucker. It's a podcast about movies, appropriate pause, and wine.
For those of you out there who don't know shit about one or both of these topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we, James and I, are here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine he loves.
We'll tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't.
Often we don't. See, I can't sneak those in with the latency.
It's a little tough. We're in the bunker. We're live on tape delay from the bunker.
That's right. From the bunker. From the Dr. Strangelove mineshaft bunker gap.
And speaking of Dr. Strangelove, we are continuing with our lighthearted No Bummers miniseries. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I want wine.
Well, today it's actually the end of the world as we know it, and I want either Aqua Cola or Guzzoline. Or mother's milk. I don't know. I got three beverage options on the shiny and chrome Fury Road. Anyway, today we are reaching the end of the end of the world as we know it with, I think, the most apocalyptic of apocalypses. This is the, like, in the genre.
It's either an apocalypse or it's not, Scott. This is a binary thing.
No.
It can't be the most apocalyptic.
This movie has more apocalypses than other apocalypses. How many apocalypses are in fucking Shaun of the Dead? One, zombie apocalypse. This movie, in the genre of like the granddaddy of all post-apocalyptic scenarios, we got your nuclear blasted wasteland, Jamie. We got a blood-stained, high octane, the world's gone mad, fucking sandy badlands from George Miller, the Australian insane madman genius. And it's Mad Max Fury fucking Road. We're talking about, yes, 2015's Mad Max Fury Road. It's the current benchmark for action cinema. It was like nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. It got thunderous applause at its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. It's the greatest goddamn movie that everyone unanimously agrees. And yet there's still things to say about it. It's gorgeous. It's mythic. It's a fucking gonzo blockbuster. I think it's the least likely masterpiece anybody ever made. And it is also a perfect movie. Fury Road.
When did gonzo become an adjective?
I don't know, but when I say a gonzo blockbuster, I'm referring to a Patrick Willems video. Patrick Willems, one of my favorite film YouTubers, and he did a great video a couple years ago called The Class of Gonzo Blockbusters. And he's mostly talking about weirdo sci-fi fantasy, like big world-building movies that are like 60% of the way there and then don't ultimately connect with the audience. So he's talking mostly about Jupiter Ascending and Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets and fucking Mortal Engines, and also Mad Max Fury Road, which is like the one example that he says that like a gonzo blockbuster that actually connected. And that people liked. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, you said it. Weirdo is the operative word there. Gonzo is canonically a weirdo.
Yeah.
That's his species. So with Mad Max Fury fucking Road, as Scott puts it, I paired Lustau Almathanista Pata de Gallina 138 Oloroso. This is a sherry, which Scott hates. I'm kind of surprised that you didn't like this one. I thought that this would be the one that connected with you.
I didn't say I didn't like it.
you have implied on several occasions, and you just growled.
Well, I heard you growling. Spoilers, Jamie, but I don't not like it.
Interesting.
I begrudgingly admire it, Jamie.
Wow. I love to hear it. We love to hear it. So Lustau, one of the largest sherry houses in Spain. We'll get into a lot more specifics, but suffice to say right now, I think this is like a really great first introduction to the world of Oloroso sherry as compared to Fino, which we explored last time on our episodes about Tenet.
Yeah, Tenet and disgusting, disgusting Fino sherry. I will now have to add that modifier when I complain about how gross sherry is, that Fino sherry, from my limited experience, is the gross one, and Oloroso is gross, but in a weird, maybe appealing way.
Oloroso is translated as aromatic.
Well, this is extremely aromatic, but we're going to save that for next time. So if you folks have been listening along at home and playing along with us, you know that the last few episodes in this miniseries, we've been breaking it up into two-parters, movie up front, and then we'll do a wine section in the following week. And we're actually planning for that this time. And so we're going to record this as a twofer. And so for today, we're going to dig in and talk about Mad Max Fury Road.
Mad Max Fury fucking Road.
Jamie, what's your thoughts? You, if recollection serves, you saw this with me, right? This was your first, I was living down near Rehoboth and we went to the movies at Midway Multiplex. Was that your first time seeing this movie?
I'm trying to remember.
The movie had been out for like at least a week at that point, because that was, I think, my third viewing. We had a couple people down around July 4th and a bunch of us went and...
So this was a summer release. Yes, yes.
This was summer of 2015.
Summer 2015.
That's right. May of 2015.
Yes, I remember that trip. I remember that viewing. I remember basically vibrating back out to the car from the movie theater.
Yeah, it's one of those.
And on my most recent watch through, which was last night, I think you can kind of forget about the subtlety of performance in a movie as, well, gonzo as this one.
Yeah. It's big and it's loud and it's always moving and it's very physical. And you're maybe not thinking about paying attention to nuance as much.
Right. But I think whether you're paying attention or not, the nuance comes across.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The emotionality lands, like whether you're conscious of it or not. But being conscious of it, Charlize Theron's, like, just her eye line is incredible to look at. Every time she gives a look into the rearview mirror, it's like this profound sadness or this fear or this like trepidation or whatever it is that she's communicating. It's so clear and sometimes devastating to see. I think she's absolutely fucking fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the, like, and this is not hyperbole, I think she gives one of the all time great leading performances in an action movie ever. Like, I would put her up there with, I don't know, like Bruce Willis in Die Hard or Sigourney Weaver in Aliens. Like, it is just an unbelievably great performance. That, like you're saying, it's all clarity, right? Like, she's doing so much physical stuff and so much action. Like we talked about when we talked about Edge of Tomorrow recently, the clarity that Tom Cruise brings to a really complex emotional arc for that character.
Yeah.
And Furiosa is the exact same. Like, you understand her and her motivations and her hesitance. And it's all just in looks and in gestures and in body language and very rarely ever in dialogue.
There is not a huge amount of dialogue in this film.
There's very little. And very little of importance. And a lot of it is added in post-production.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like the whole movie, well, first of all, they ADR'd the whole thing. We've talked about ADR on the show before, right? Which is...
I don't think we have.
ADR is looping. It's when they re-record the dialogue for whatever reason, right? So like there was too much noise on set the day and they didn't get a good recording and the actor has to come back in and they do playback up on the screen and the actor kind of rehearses it a few times and then they try and sync up their rereading of the dialogue to their own mouth movements on the day. And sometimes you'll do ADR because there are sound issues, and sometimes you'll do it because you want to change performance, and sometimes you'll do ADR because you want to change a line of dialogue. So like you'll ADR a line of dialogue when somebody's off screen, right? Like we're on Furiosa and then we cut to Max and then we cut back to Furiosa. But then while we're looking at her, we hear Max say something very quickly. And it's often a way to like cram exposition in for something that's not clear in the edit. There's a little bit of that in this, like a lot of Max's dialogue in the first half of the movie, what little he has, aside from like grunts and growls, is shit that looks like is added, where it's like Hardy's head is just kind of tilted down a little bit and he's like doing some classic Tom Hardy mumbling. And then there's a line where he's like, water, not you. And like, it's just they're just adding stuff to make him a little bit more clear. But you never get that with her. You always understand her deal completely. Whereas his character is, I think, much more obscured in the beginning. Like he's a feral, broken, insane, wild man. And he's just harder to kind of glom onto.
Also, I don't know. I feel like the two of them next to each other, not that Tom Hardy is a bad actor, not that it's a bad performance even, but she shines so much brighter than he does.
Why she, so there's a lot there. So she has a better part, first of all. Like, I think if you break it down, like just looking at the movie, he is the protagonist. Like it's his journey. We start with him. We end with him. It's his emotional journey that we're kind of witnessing her much more interesting story through the lens of. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. That's not how I'd thought about it, because she's very much centered in this movie for me.
I think they're co-leads in terms of just like who has the most screen time and who is driving the plot. And like Furiosa drives the plot, but it is Max's journey to regain his humanity just at like the bare minimum. And then to kind of remember who he used to be and who he valued as, like, and remembering that, like, I place value on helping people. And even though I've lost people in the past, doesn't mean that I'm not going to try to help people again in the future. So like, it's his journey, but then her character just pops way harder. She has the more dynamic part to play. And then there's also some stuff, and like, you never know how this is actually, like how this realizes on screen, but the two of them apparently did not get along for the 6 months of shooting of this movie.
Really?
They have very different acting styles apparently. And Hardy was like doing something different every single take. He was just experimenting and he was wild. And like the burden of an emotional narrative feels like it lands on her shoulders heavier than it is on him in this movie.
Yes, I'd agree with that.
And also, like, the production of the movie sounds like it was hellish, especially for the actors. Because the way you film car chase scenes when you're shooting out in the Namibian desert and your principal location is also a vehicle where, like, many of your dialogue scenes or action scenes are on a truck. You know, they're on the fucking war rig. They're driving through the desert. There's the five wives in the back seat and Max and Furiosa sitting up front. And maybe there's like another dozen pursuit vehicles going on as well. And then George Miller is in, like, he's in a remote video village, which is like on a traditional set, is where all of your monitors are set up. So the DP and the director and whoever else can like watch the playback and make sure that everything is working, or not even playback. They're watching it live. And then if he wants to give input on a take, it's either relayed or it's over a walkie or a headset. And like it sounds like it was a very alienating experience for the actors to like make the movie.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
It led to great difficulties. Miller admitted that he, similarly when we talked about Shaun of the Dead, where Edgar Wright was like one of his failings on that movie, was not getting everybody on board.
The camera team had no idea what was going on.
Yeah, or they just didn't buy it. Like they just didn't understand what his MO was. Miller admits that he like failed to properly explain to everybody what the vibe and the feeling of the movie was going to be. And then at this surprisingly emotional Cannes press conference after the premiere, Tom Hardy opened it up by giving a lengthy apology to George Miller and being like, hey, I didn't get it when we were shooting and I apologize and I should have seen what you were doing and you're a genius and I get it now. And I think the movie is beautiful and I wish I hadn't been so difficult when we were filming. I wish I had understood
Jesus,
like how good you were.
That's pretty cool.
It's super cool, but then, like, I don't know, man. One of the many announcements for the existence of this movie was that at one point it was going to be a twofer, and they were going to do Mad Max Fury Road, and then they already had a script ready for a film called Furiosa. So her character was already getting lined up to basically be spun off. And there were difficulties on the set, and I don't know if this has any reason in it, but the Furiosa movie is a prequel and it stars Anya Taylor-Joy, who is a terrific actor. And I would love to see her in the role, but also, oh my God,
Charlize Theron. Yeah,
she owns that part. Yes. You can't recast that. I'm sorry. Like the reason that character
works. You can.
I mean, you can. And I shouldn't doubt George Miller, because I doubted this project until the first Comic-Con trailer came out. And then it became the thing I most wanted to see in the world. But I don't know, it feels like a misstep, but we're not here talking about that. We're not talking about the Furiosa.
We're absolutely not. So the last thing that I want to say is a thing that I hadn't thought about as I was in previous watch throughs of this movie. So Max leaves at the end, right? And they share a knowing look, him and Furiosa, as he's like disappearing into the crowd.
Yeah. So this is like the beautiful climactic finale. And after having spent an hour driving in one direction and then 45 minutes driving back in the other direction. Max and Furiosa and the heroes have seemingly escaped or vanquished Immortan Joe and all of his war boys and the fucking...
And they have taken control of the Citadel.
Yeah, they've taken the Citadel and they're ascending, right? Furiosa and the other wives, they're on the elevator and they're going up and... Beautiful drums and Max just... walks away into the crowd. And you don't like that.
He walks away after having had this journey where he was going to leave them in the desert and then gets sort of roped into this runaway chase, right? And then they finally get to their destination. They develop a plan, which he knows is bunk. He allows them to go off onto the salt before having a crisis of conscience and convincing them to go back and take the Citadel with him. And then after all of that emotional catharsis and going back through the pass and killing Immortan Joe and returning to the Citadel, now he's spent and he's going to go back to the Wastelands. There's something about that that didn't connect this time. It felt appropriate every other time. If he's just going to walk off, then why even bother telling them to come back to the Citadel?
For my part, I find that ending extremely satisfying. And it's true to the character as well. And I'm not saying the character as he was depicted in the three previous Mad Max movies with Mel Gibson, because like truthfully, just like the Sergio Leone, quote unquote, Man with No Name trilogy, like these movies are not really narratively connected in any kind of way. In the prologue of each of them, there may or may not be like lip service paid to events that happened in the previous movies. I mean, like even like in the first Mad Max, Max's kid is killed and it's his son. And now in this one, the fourth one, when he has visions of all of these people in the beginning of the movie or the ghosts of all the friends that he failed to save over the years, the one, like you're saying, the ghost that gives him the pang of conscience to go back or to help Furiosa and the wives and to tell them like we should go back to the Citadel instead of going out across the salt, that girl calls him Papa. Like she lures him out onto the sand. She's like, come on, Papa. Like, it was a long tangent to get back to my main point, which is that I don't mean the continuity of the character across the whole series, but just the character that Tom Hardy is playing. Like he's a broken loner and his journey in the movie is not finding a home or finding family, right? His journey in the movie is regaining his agency over his body after he's been taken by Immortan Joe's people and turned into a fucking blood bag. It's to regain his like personhood, which we see like, you know, thematically that comes about in just taking the mask off, like the enormous catharsis that he gets from getting the fucking like steel clawed like mask off of his face.
Yeah.
And then like deciding that he wants to engage with people and that what he says to Furiosa that night, basically after the disappointment of getting to the green place, tells her hope out here is a mistake. All it'll do is make you crazy. Like, and then he rejects that in the very next scene. I think that's his journey. What is he going to do? Is he going to settle down in the Citadel? He's not a leader, certainly, right? Like, it would be inappropriate for him to be on that platform, the elevator that's taking Furiosa and the rest of them up. He can't lead. He doesn't really have a place here. His place is out on the road helping people. And I think that's his journey. And I think that's what he's realized by the end of the movie.
I can be down with that. You make a good defense of it, and intellectually it makes sense. It still doesn't, I don't know, maybe it was just my frame of mind during this watch through and the isolation of like the last 2 years or whatever, but like.
You don't want him to walk away from community. It bothers you that he walks back out into the desolate wasteland.
Yes, correct, Scott.
That is fair. I do think there's an honesty and a truth to it, but I also understand how that is very depressing.
So fucking depressing. And I don't know, it hadn't bothered me at all until this rewatch. And then I'm watching them like make eyes at each other and her giving him this like understanding look and him just turning around and going like there's warmth there, but there's also like, as you say, this is not my place. And I'm just like, oh my God, dude, you finally made a human connection by the end of this movie and you're fucking walking away from it.
Yeah. I think he's going to make more. I think it's the idea that it ends with hope for her and for the brides of Immortan Joe and for the one remaining of the many mothers and for all the people of the Citadel. Like it ends optimistically for them, but then there's also hope for him that like he can't change in a fundamental way. Like, he's always going to be this broken loner, but at least he can finally accept that, like, I'm pretty good at going out there and getting into scrapes and helping people when they need them. So I guess I'm going to go and do that some more because I did some good here.
That's totally fair.
I would love to hear exactly what I just said in Tom Hardy's, like, signature marble grumble, 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 grumble marble mouth bullshit that he does in this movie.
That would be great.
That would be outstanding.
Do you think that he is on what's that platform where
Cameo?
Cameo, that's
Jamie,
it.
If Tom Hardy is on Cameo, your mission in life now is to, for my birthday, get me a birthday greeting from Tom Hardy as Venom and Eddie Brock. I would like both of those characters to wish me a happy birthday. If Tom Hardy
is on Cameo. Okay, I will make a note of it for your next birthday, which is roughly, what, 340 days from now?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I had touched on about the lengthy development and the number of announcements that, like, led to the existence of this movie, right?
Yes.
This is one of the things we talked about when we had our little pre-miniseries planning session when you were trying to figure out what you would want to pair with things. And one of the things I drilled down on is I told you that it was perfect because it had time to age. And that it gave Miller and his collaborators time to whittle the movie down to something that is perfect. And I think there is perfection in the script per se, and I think there's perfection in the craft and the visual communication. And all of that just comes across to this, like, crazy superlative experience. It's something we'll be, spoilers, sneak preview, talking about a lot in our upcoming miniseries. It is what film critic Matt Singer has dubbed a Lego sequel, which I'm particularly fond of as a term. Which is a sequel. Yeah, or a portmanteau of legacy sequel, which is this increasing.
That wasn't clear to me. Thank you for explaining that.
You're welcome. It's not a sequel that's devoted to your, you know, lower limbs. No, it's this increasing trend of studios digging up IP or franchises that have maybe been dormant for a while, and you not just do a sequel to it, but you do a sequel that acknowledges the passage of time, a sequel that somehow has fandom incorporated. And frequently, Lego sequels will do the thing that fans like to do, which is just, like, skip all of the other sequels that maybe nobody else likes and just go back, and they're going to be a sequel to the first one. This movie came about, it happened the same year as The Force Awakens. It's only a year after Jurassic World. Or is it the same year as Jurassic World? I don't know. That movie's unbelievably forgettable. But so, like, it came about in that trend, but, like, the last Mad Max movie came out in 1986.
That's true and sad. From 86 to 2015.
Yeah. And that was, so George Miller, without doing, like, a full blank check style, like, deep dive on his filmography, George Miller, like, made a few experimental films while he was in medical school. He was an ER doctor and then quit that. And with his partner, they, you know, financed and produced the first Mad Max. Knowing that he was an ER doctor, a lot of the bodily harm that happens to people in George Miller action movies makes an awful lot more sense.
That's a whole topic that I'm sure that we could get into, but right, we're not going to.
Not today. But so the first Mad Max is 79. The second one, Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, and then the third one, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, are 82 and 86. Like, those are his first three feature films. And then he puts the franchise to bed. The reason that he wanted to do sequels is that by the end of making the first one, he's like, oh shit, I could do this so much better. I've learned so much. Like, I could do car chases and stunts way better. And so the second one ends up being a very, very, very soft reboot of the first movie. Like, it's a sequel where, other than the main character and his car, like, everything is radically different, right? The first movie takes place in a world that's on the verge of societal collapse. And the second movie takes place in, like, a desert wasteland.
Right.
And then the third movie is basically a sequel to the second one. It's not as much of a huge reinvention, but the action is this, like, quantum leap in what he's able to achieve. I think the action in Thunderdome is better than all the stuff that's in The Road Warrior. The Road Warrior is just a way better movie and doesn't have, like, 40 minutes of the fucking Goonies in the middle of it, which drives me crazy about Thunderdome.
Was there a meaningful budget difference between Road Warrior and Thunderdome?
Oh, yeah. I mean, because Road Warrior, he still produced, I think, largely, like, outside of the US, whereas Thunderdome, like, I think he had Warner Brothers come on, and there was a huge, huge, huge budget, and he had a lot more resources to make it. But then he had such a horrible fucking experience with the studios that, like, the rest of his career was all about, if he worked with the studio, he would find a way to protect himself and, like, screw them if he could, essentially, to get the movie made. But so he does the first three movies, has this weird and fascinating career that we could talk for ages about. But then by 1999, he comes back and he's got an idea for a new Mad Max movie that they're planning to shoot in 2001. Except then 9/11 happens, and the movie that was supposed to shoot in Australia, now the dollar has tanked in its value against the Australian dollar.
Jesus Christ.
And the budget goes way up. So at this point, the movie was at Fox and they, you know, put it to bed for a while.
So 9/11 fucked up Mad Max.
Yeah. 9/11.
That's the real reason for 9/11 was to stop Mad Max from shooting.
Okay. Well, that's not fair. I mean, pro, it does spare us from having another Mel Gibson movie, which I guess this would have been back before we all knew what a complete piece of shit Mel Gibson is.
Correct.
But con, that joke is not funny, Jamie. As someone it's who just recently funny. Had to explain what 9/11 was to a 5-year-old.
Oh boy.
That joke was
How
not terribly
How did that conversation
funny.
Go?
You know, interestingly...
I'm sure it had much more of an emotional impact on you than it did on him.
Oh, yeah. He just conceptually, like, he even brought it up a few days later. He's like, Daddy, those people who crashed those planes into those buildings, that was not a very good plan to get America to stop doing the things that they didn't like. I'm like, no, my friend, it was not a good plan. It did not work out for anyone at all.
My God.
He's very pragmatic. He is his mother's child.
That is correct. Oh, my Lord.
But yeah, so 9/11 delays Mad Max Fury Road. Then by 2003, they're ready to get going again, except that the Iraq war has created major hurdles to security and shipping. So the costs are going to go way up. And at that point, they were planning to shoot in the Namibian desert. Then after that, for a while, Miller starts talking about how it's going to be an animated movie. He had done one at that point, one of the two Happy Feet movies. He was real big into like CGI animation, and it was going to be animated. And he was very closely involved in a tie-in video game with, I think, the creators of God of War or God of War 2. And that was going to be a 2012 release. And then it switches back and it's going to be live action. And in 2009, they're location scouting. And supposedly, and this has never been confirmed, that all of the vehicles had been built for years from like back in like 2001, 2003, when they were initially going to do it.
What?
And they just had this fleet of vehicles that were just waiting. In Australia.
Okay.
2010, Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron are cast. They are ready to begin principal photography in the Australian outback in November. And then the outback has a fucking climate change, historically unprecedented rainy season. The outback is now covered in wildflowers. So they have to shut down.
This is the funniest of the setbacks.
It's so wild. So they shut down pre-production and then they're like, fine, we'll go back to Namibia. So then 7 months later, July 2012, they finally start shooting. And that takes 6 months. And then for funsies, they were, you know, shooting a movie like this, which is largely for real, like real cars, real deserts, real locations, real stunts. It's very complicated. And there were a lot of delays and they went over schedule and over budget and the studio wouldn't give them any more time. So Miller and his producers are evil geniuses. And they said, fine. So they shuffled around the shooting schedule and they put everything at the Citadel at the end of the shooting schedule. So that when they ran out of time and money, they cut together the movie and they gave it to the studio. And the studio was like, this is really good, but what the fuck? How does it start and how does it end? And they're like, oh, well, we need more money to go back and shoot all that stuff.
That's brilliant.
So then a year after principal photography wrapped, they went back and spent another few months shooting everything at the Citadel, essentially.
Wow.
I say all of that because in all of that time, in all of that time of delays and starts and stops and like aborted production, there was opportunity for refinement. It gave them time to write and to rewrite and to work on the designs and to work on the visuals and to keep testing. Like there's footage of stunt teams working on things like the polecat tests. The polecat's the guys up on the poles who dip down just when you think the movie is the craziest thing you've possibly seen. Then the fucking polecats come in from out of frame. And then I just start having like a heart attack for the last 20 minutes of the movie.
How the dudes that are on the tips of like swinging poles are one of the more menacing villains you come across is beyond
me. You think they're quite vulnerable, right?
And yet you would think that, but then they just like, they snatch you right out of the vehicle that you're in. And you're like, God, oh, this so is good. A huge major threat. Jesus.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just, they had time. They had time to figure it out. Like we talked about this. I'm sure I've told you this before. One of my favorite things about the development of this movie is that it was years into pre-production before there was a screenplay, but the entire story was already locked in because Miller didn't work from a script. He knew he wanted to do something that was purely action. And that was entirely from the visuals. And even from the earliest stages, the concept was always, what if the entire movie is a chase? And so instead of starting from a literary place and starting with the word, he started with a storyboard artist. So if the Warner Brothers people or the financiers or anybody wanted to like know what the story was, they would be given a massive book of storyboards. You could go into George Miller's office during pre-production and he could just show you the entire movie because every wall was covered in the storyboards. And he would sequentially walk people through the whole film.
You're describing this whole process, and I'm totally with you that like the time that it takes or the time that they were afforded to continue honing this thing and refine it and rewrite it and whittle it down to just the things that work is the reason or one of a few reasons why this is so successful. However, I find it massively impressive, not just that the time happened, but that the work continued during that time. The drive to continue honing this thing was still there and it didn't sit on a shelf somewhere for 20 years. That's kind of wild to me.
I mean, there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, one is that George Miller is brilliant and is not just a great director, but also it seems like he's a pretty savvy businessman and he knows how to play things with the studios. And two is that, Jamie, and we've talked about this a lot, Mad Max is a recognizable brand name around the world, which means it is IP that needs to be exploited. So like there was always interest from a studio in, oh, you're going to make a new action movie that we can sell all around the planet and it has a two-word title that everybody knows? Like, great. Of course we're going to make that. So there was always like continued interest in it. And I don't want to say that they just worked on this during that time. Like between 99 and 2015, like George Miller released the two Happy Feet movies. He worked on a ton of projects. He spent years, like 2 years in pre-production and development on a Justice League movie that ultimately never happened, which would have been totally fucking crazy. And his casting sounded amazing on it. But they were basically like ready to go. And I think they were a few weeks away from starting principal photography. Like sets had been built. They had pre-vised the whole movie. It had been cast. Everybody had done costume fittings, thoroughly canceled, terrible human being. Armie Hammer still will go around apparently showing people pictures of the Batman costume that was made for him. That just sounds super rad. But like a whole bunch of other shit happened during that time period. But yeah, they just kept coming back to it. And that's not usually the way things work out.
It's wild that in downtime that it was still like, this is probably going to still happen. I have hope for it. I have drive to continue whittling this thing down. And I mean, the proof is on the goddamn screen. Like it is shaved down to what works. Like if it's on screen, it's there to tell you what's going on or to give you texture on the world that you're inhabiting. And there's very little else. There isn't anything that's unnecessary for getting the points across. You know, when you gave me that particular note on time being used as a way to whittle this down to the necessities when we were going through the pairing, my immediate thought was Sherry, and specifically Fino Sherry, because of the way the floor interacts with the wine. It strips down the glycerol and it becomes a very lean saline type wine without any fat, without any embellishment. And then I started to think about this movie in particular and how rich the world is and how kind of explosive and dynamic it is. And it led me more to the Oloroso sherry. Anyway, that's just like, it was intuitive for me when you gave me that note. Like, yeah, this movie feels like it was honed, like the edge of a blade.
Right. There's a famous, beloved, extremely influential Russian filmmaker, Andrei Tarkovsky. You would know him from, no, you would definitely not have seen any of his movies. You saw the remake of Solaris, right? The Soderbergh, George Clooney Solaris movie?
No, I didn't see it.
Damn it. All right. Never mind. Well, anyway, that is a remake of one of his very famous films. But so Tarkovsky, he wrote a book that kind of summarized his worldview on filmmaking. And the book is called Sculpting in Time. His fascination is about time. He has very long scenes, very long takes. He has somnambulant movies, right? Like his stuff is very sleepy and dreamy and slow. And so he called film Sculpting in Time. And I think that sculpting in time for me really is kind of what I'm getting at with the Fury Road comparison. Because like the works of George Miller and Mad Max Fury Road are nothing like an Andrei Tarkovsky film. But I think the act of sculpting in time doesn't just apply to the time that you spend on set.
Right.
Right. Like Tarkovsky is talking about like the time of, you know, the film running through the camera and the time that's happening on screen and using actors and technicians and artists and lighting to like change an image and to sculpt through time. Time is the medium that you're sculpting in. I think that time doesn't just start when the camera starts rolling. I think pre-production is also an act of sculpting. That is also a process of refinement, using different tools and different medium. Like Miller spent over a decade sculpting and shaping this movie before they ever rolled cameras. And I think you can feel all of that in every little shape and movement in the perfection of the movie. One of the things that came out of all of their time in planning and prep for this movie came from the cinematographer, John Seal, and the editor, Margaret Sixel, who have both been longtime collaborators.
Collaborators is the word you're looking for.
That sounds bad. That makes it sound like they sold people out to the Nazis.
It's the same word, different meaning.
They both have been longtime collaborators of George Miller's, and their conceit that kind of evolved together was that if the entire movie is action and we have action that's existing on multiple axes with multiple cars moving in different directions and different people, you're going to be cutting so fucking often that it will be chaos for the audience to be able to like just pay attention to things if you're cutting that fast, right? Like neurologists have studied this and filmmakers have then studied what the neurologists have studied. Like your brain needs a certain amount of frames of film. Right. Like there's 24 frames a second in conventional cinema presentation.
Right.
Your brain needs a certain number of frames before you can register what you're looking at and then spatially orient it to the shot that came before. And so their big conceit to make this as easy as possible for the audience is I think it's even on some of the monitors during the filming. They put a bullseye dead center of the frame. So every single shot, your subject is basically in the center. They're in the target, which means the brain never has to look from left to right, right? There's not a shot of Nux's car coming up on the left side of the frame, and then we cut to Furiosa, and her head is on the right side of the frame, which is typically how you would do an editing rhythm like that, right? To show that
right.
This person's here and this person's there. We don't put them both on the same side of the frame because it creates an imbalance, and sometimes you want that, but like not in action. You want clarity and geography, and so they just put everything dead center in the frame. And if you go back and watch the movie, you could almost crop off the sides of the image and still be able to follow everything because it's right there in the center. And I think that kind of thing only happens as a result of like iteration and process and practice. And it is, and nobody even fucking noticed it. That was the crazy thing. It was only weeks after the movie that came out that George Seal and some of the other people in the camera team did like a long symposium about the craft of the movie. And the audience gasped when he just put up an image on screen with the bullseye dead center in the frame. Because it's the simplest idea, just like make it easy for people. And it works so effectively.
And it's so intuitive that you don't even think about it.
Yeah. I read this great book recently. I got it from film critic Matt Zoller Seitz. He has an independent bookstore that he's running that is mostly cinema books that I've gotten a few things from. We can throw out a link to it. It's an independently published book, The Cinema of Survival, and it's 12 essays about Fury Road. The author is a guy named Matthew Brown, and he breaks down so much of the craft of the visual construction and like the styling. And Brown talks about how the movie essentially is two symphonies.
Two symphonies?
So think about from not the prologue with like Bearded Max getting captured and then, you know, he thinks he gets branded and then you think he's going to escape the War Boys and then he doesn't. Starting from Furiosa, like we start on the V8 brand, right? The V8 is the god that Immortan Joe has them all worshiping. We start with the brand, the like skull and the wheel on the back of her neck, her walking towards the war rig. And then that whole scene, her setting off, her veering off course, the pursuit, and then all of that initial action up through the fire tornadoes, the like mega storm.
Oh my God.
So cool. And then the big crash. So cool. great visuals. That whole sequence, Matthew Brown describes as a symphony. And it is kind of like teaching you how the action is going to work in the movie, but it also works as a complete piece unto itself. You introduce a character, you introduce a conflict, you start building out the world, you start introducing more characters in conflict with Nux, and then all of that gets a buildup and then kind of a resolution. And then you by the end of that sequence, it's like, oh my God, this is the greatest action I've ever seen. I've never seen something more thrilling and gorgeous and unhinged from reality that still feels weight. And it's so thrilling and exciting and wild. And then the movie has like this second act where there's more complications and chases and we build the relationships. And then the last symphony, as he describes it, is the final action scene. Like when they decide we're going to go back. The whole first symphony is just teaching you how to watch the last one, which is even more thrilling and more complex and with more destruction and insanity and character payoffs. Like, how crazy is it that you have all of these emotional resolutions and character payoffs and thematic resolutions in a car chase?
It's kind of nuts. There are other movies that accomplish like a lot of character development and plot and, you know, say things through action. I think this is like top tier in that category.
Part of what I like about Max exiting the story, essentially, like the movie's over and he walks away and he doesn't stay at the Citadel with Furiosa and the rest,
right,
is, do you notice that on the platform that's raising, right, and those like final shots when she's looking down at him, and then there's that amazing last shot of the elevator basically cutting vertically across the screen, and then we go to black, and then it's credits?
Yes.
It's all women on that platform?
Yes, I did notice that.
Yeah. So I certainly will not be the first person to discuss the feminist themes of this movie, and I'm far from, you know, even remotely qualified to do it. But like, I think that is part of what's so honest and satisfying to me about the end of the movie, is that like, this is a movie about, it's a movie about women breaking out of prisons that like bad agent, fucking shitty warlord, toxic, possessive men want to put them in. And I think Max, not that Max is, you know, woke or an ally or anything, but like, what does Furiosa say about him when they get to what she thinks is to the green place? Like
the many mothers, yeah. Who are the men? They're reliable,
right? Max, I think, recognizes that he does not have a place in the world that Furiosa is about to build. And I think he, not that he thinks like he's part of the problem, but I think he recognizes that, like, not just based on, as I've said, like him being a broken like person who is better suited to wandering the wasteland and trying to help people out in danger. I think there's that, but I think it's also like he sees that this is an opportunity for women to step up and lead in this terrible world and maybe do something good. And maybe he's just going to be part of the problem.
That is, yes.
The movie paints a very clear picture of like, look at these three fucking toxic warlords in the Bullet Farmer and the People Eater and in Immortan Joe / President 45. He is, Jamie. He just is.
I know he is.
Okay.
Mediocre.
But yeah, like there's a chance for like, I don't know, maybe men shouldn't be in charge of the world is something that this very male-centric, ostensibly, in terms of the marketing, like movie is trying to suppose. And I feel like Max is maybe keyed into that. Like, you know what? They might have a better chance if I'm not around. Maybe I'm not going to be any good for anyone.
You said it earlier that Max is not himself a leader. Yeah, no, I like that read on the movie. I think it's very clear, especially as all of the women are ascending to Valhalla.
Well, except not, because I don't know if you keyed in on this, Jamie, but...
Don't patronize me right now.
Well, I'm just saying, Jamie, Valhalla's not real in the world of the movie. And Immortan Joe is a liar and a scam artist and, you know, creating a cult of personality around his deranged self. So yeah, they're not ascending to Valhalla. They're not buying into bullshit. They're going to roll up their sleeves and do the work. And I don't know, maybe give people water once in a while.
Yes, correct.
This is another thing that like through iteration and through honing, like fairly late in the pre-production game, it may have even been during production, that Miller invited Eve Ensler to the set. She's a feminist and a human rights activist, and like she most famously is the author of the Vagina Monologues.
Okay.
He had seen her give a talk about human rights in Sydney, and he was like, hey, can you come out to the set? Because like I'm doing this movie and here's the basic themes and the story of it. And like, I feel like your perspective would be valuable for my cast. So he brought her out. She spent like a week on set. And by set, I mean the desert, hanging out in, you know, warlord cars. And she mostly just talked with the five actors who were playing the wives. And they just asked her a bunch of questions like, what would it have been like to have been a sex slave? And, you know, a number of other things that I feel like just reading them was like triggering for me as, you know, one of the most privileged classes of people on the earth. And I wouldn't dare inflict that on anybody else. But yeah, like that is just something that like occurred to him fairly late in the game. And like that wouldn't happen if, you know, 9/11 hadn't prevented this movie from happening with Mel Gibson in the first place.
Well, thank you, Serendipity, for giving us this really incredibly well sculpted through time movie.
Through time.
We talked a bit about the flavor that is in this movie. And as I was talking about how the there's not like unnecessary stuff in this movie, I think some might read some of the flourish around this movie to not be necessary. And I'm referring specifically to the characters and the things and the phrases that are not expounded upon at all. Things like the doof warrior, the crazy dude raging on the guitar for the whole convoy, or any of Immortan Joe's lieutenants, the people eater or the bullet farmer, the stilt walker people who are
the crows. Going through them. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, they're amazing, aren't they?
They're so cool.
A lesser filmmaker would have made a whole movie about those guys. And instead, they're just a texture for like one shot.
Right. There's so much of that in this movie. And I for sure, I know that like the con community, people who are into like cosplaying and fan fiction and whatever, have glommed onto a lot of it.
Oh, okay. You mean like Comic-Con, not like a one of many legitimate pronunciations of C-A-N-N-E-S, the French International Film Festival. Got
correct.
It. No, I was going to say, yes. I have seen a lot of red carpets at Cannes, and I've never seen any cosplay, but who knows? Who knows? Maybe this year will be weird.
I mean, this year is weird.
Yeah.
Just it is. But I wonder what your feeling on all of that flavor is. Do you think any of it reaches the level of distraction, or is it all like, for me, it feels like this is all kind of beautiful texture for the world and somehow doesn't end up being distracting. But I could, especially like the fucking people eater with his shiny chrome nose and elephant feet. Like I could see someone being annoyed that they don't know more about that guy.
I mean, I'm like, this is the biggest complaint I'll say about the movie, is that I'm annoyed that I don't have more about all of them. Like, for as much as I am skeptical of a prequel about Furiosa, like, Jamie, give me a fucking 10 episode HBO Max limited series about the fucking doof warrior and I will be so happy. I don't think any of it rises to the level of distraction, and none of it sticks out because it's all of that stuff you're talking about, not just characters or bits of world building that are unsaid or unexplained, but things that are weird, right? Like this is what you're talking about, the stuff that's like big and weird. And I think the reason that none of it sticks out is because it's all thematically tied in, like it's all resonant and congruent with what the themes of the main plot of the movie are. And because aesthetically they don't stick out, you know? The doof warrior makes perfect sense in this movie. Like he
obviously, like, this is the little drummer boy of the wasteland.
Yeah.
He keeps pace for the convoy.
He's amazing. I'm getting chills just thinking of it. Every single time, again, talking about like that first big action sequence, that symphony, it's right about in the middle of it. And once the war drums start up, right? Immortan Joe has fucking run into where the wives are, and we are not things. And he sets off the war boys after them, and the drums start, and it gets your fucking pulse pounding, and you are just as amped up as those like young, crazy, bloodthirsty, like suicide bombing men. And then the camera comes up behind the truck that has all the drums and the amps on it. And then the camera whips around as it's coming up, and we reveal the doof warrior wailing on his guitar, like two dozen armored vehicles in like the sea of the desert behind him. And then he lets loose with a riff and the flamethrower goes off. I get chills every single time. It is like one of the most ecstatic images I've ever seen in a fucking movie. And then it keeps going and gets better and weirder. The Doof Warrior is my guy. You know that that guy was an actual guitar player and that all of those amps were real and that he would play on set for them every day?
That's fucking wild.
Isn't that the best? Like, it's not so, it's not so cool. Fake. Like, he's really just like playing and wailing the entire time. And he's having such a good time too.
Especially when like Max is fighting him.
Yeah. And he's like, he just wants his guitar back.
He just keeps getting his guitar back and playing more. And you're like, oh my God, it's his only purpose.
Yeah.
Like, you get the feeling that that's all this person does.
Yeah. Well, but that, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, he, not only does he look like he fits into a world of people driving souped up, dusty cars covered in leather and having like steampunk robot arms, but he also fits in so thematically with everything else. Like, I think the movie is, among many other things, the thing that resonates with me a lot is it's about the commodification of the body.
Right.
Right. And this is all stuff that's like very, very surface level, but it's women who are being owned and possessed for breeding and for the creation of milk, right? Their bodies are commodities in two different ways. You have Max being turned into a supply of blood. He's been turned into a commodity. The war boys themselves, like the fact that they're all, we only get the sense from Nux, but there's a reference later on to the fact that like war boys who were too sick to come out and fight. So like seemingly all the war boys are maybe terminal as a result of like whatever, how the world has gone bad and gone sick. I got
that idea just kind of intuitively,
right,
from them being introduced by Immortan Joe as his half-life war boys.
Right, exactly. So the half-life war boys, like these guys are also possessed and commodified by Joe. These are tools that he can use. And you're talking about the Doof Warrior. Like, he is strapped into, like he's got bungee cords essentially on, but he is strapped into the vehicle. He is blind. So even if he could get out of the straps, he couldn't go anywhere. He too has become property. He's property of Joe. So I think he fits neatly with everything else. Same thing with the people eater and the truly deranged bullet farmer, the guy who is like, he reaches out with his long pistols and starts just shooting into the darkness and I'm just probing. So good.
It's so good.
Those three guys, the warlords, they found their commodities, the things that they own, and that all just feels like it nests together very well. And that's why I don't feel like any of it sticks out. It is reminiscent to me in a way, and probably just thinking of it because I've been reading the J.W. Rinzler coffee table book, The Making of Star Wars, but like it feels very much like Star Wars. You know, Star Wars has a ton of world building, and most of it happens just in design.
Right.
It's in behavior and it's in set decoration and vehicles and props and costuming. You know, you get so much of the most important world building in this movie just through what you're looking at. Like the movie would be less if they talked it all through and if they explained it all. Even if I am like desperate for all of those little details from the demented minds of the people who came up with this movie.
I think part of the reason why I bring this up is A, because there is so much flavor here and it's uncommon in a lot of movies that we watch,
yeah,
that there's this like this sense of this deeper, much, much deeper world.
Yeah.
That's a common feature of video games and specifically of role-playing games.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of this stuff like littered throughout the world, but in a video game, you have the option to like click on it and learn everything about it. And that can be a distraction. And it frequently is. Like I played through Dragon Age Origins in the first month of the pandemic. And I found myself like for an hour just scrolling through the
codex or whatever they call it.
The codex. Yeah. Like learning about some of the back lore and then realizing, oh my God, I have not made any progression through this game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're right. For me, when I play, like, not that I play a lot of like super long, deep games, but like, yeah, Dragon Age Inquisition was the last like big role-playing game that I got into a few years ago. And yeah, it was just like, there's just too much shit. There's too much reading. Show me the world building through the story, through the narrative, through the visuals and the gameplay mechanics. But like, if you're going to give me a ton of stuff to read, like that is not the medium that I'm engaging with here.
Right.
And I feel like Miller probably has the same sensibility. Like if people wanted tons and tons and tons of like, again, like literary, like verbal backstory and explanations, then he should have written a book. But he's a filmmaker, so he's going to give you the pictures. As a counterexample, like something that does the opposite of this, my son and I, for Christmas, we got him a gigantic Lego pirate ship that he's in love with. And we were flipping
through. Love a Lego pirate ship.
Oh, it's so cool. But we were flipping through the, you know, apps and whatever, and he saw one of the Pirates movies, and I was like, all right, the first one's probably fine. And so over the course of like a week and a half, we watched all three of the, I say all three because I will never watch the fourth and fifth, all three of the original Pirates of the Caribbean movies. And we had a good time. And, you know, those movies are an extremely mixed bag. But you know what I really, really don't need is so much fucking pirate lore. Oh my God. They just bury you in lore and rules and mythology and backstory and all of this shit. And it's like, no, give me the Fury Road version. Like, your production designer is a genius. Your costume designer is great. You, Gore Verbinski, you can come up with all these amazing set pieces and all this great action. And you have this great cast. And just like, just show it to me and stop fucking talking all the time.
Yeah, I fully agree. Those movies are a little fat.
Jimmy, the third one is 3 hours long.
I did not watch the third. I've only seen the first and the second one.
The third one, I mean, they're all frustrating. I think they're all frustrating. But the third one has a climax that is so ingenious and brilliantly staged and exhilarating to watch that it makes the 2.5 hours preceding it even more infuriating. It would be like if this movie ended in the exact same way, but we spent 2.5 hours like negotiating with the various factions of the desert warlords to get them all to come to agree. And then we come together and then somebody has to show up and bring out like the Road Warriors rule book. And we spend 20 minutes arguing about the rules, trying to trick people. It would be unbearable. And it is. It's called Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End.
And it is unbearable.
Yeah.
But this is not a podcast about the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Nor will it ever be.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah.
It is long past time that we dove into the relevance of this movie to this miniseries.
Of the end of the world.
That's right.
As we know it. And I would like.
And I want wine.
I want some wine. Well, you know, let me turn the tables on you a little bit here, because this has been, I've been steering the ship on this miniseries, and I've talked plenty of it. What do you, James Jamie Harrison Rubin III, think about the end of the world scenarios presented in this movie? Which of them gives you the Wiggins the worst?
I mean, so presented in this movie, we're talking about nuclear holocaust, climate change, and then the subsequent societal collapse.
Right.
Or possibly concurrent societal collapse.
Yeah.
All of them?
All of them? All of them you're worried about?
Well, so we're currently watching the planet warm up to unsustainable levels, right?
Yes.
We know this. It's terrifying. And every time that I hear about it, I try and make jokes about it because that's kind of all I can do. Aside from attempt to live my life in, you know, a slightly less bad way.
Yeah, man. Isn't that like the greatest lie that anybody ever fed you in the first grade, when it was like, well, global warming is happening, but if we all recycle, we can turn this around in a couple decades. Like, right. It's on the individual to solve these problems.
Oh God, don't get me started on this fucking lie.
I digress. I apologize. I got you started.
Yeah. And fucking how it was perpetuated by the people who were actually doing the fucking polluting. Anyway, moving right the fuck along. So climate change is happening.
It's here, baby.
There's microplastic everywhere.
Yep.
You know, the ecosystems are collapsing worldwide, and we are just literally watching it happen. It has felt like in the past, we'll call it 5 to 6 years, like society is actually collapsing.
It does feel that way.
I know that we're coming from a very like leftist liberal kind of viewpoint, but it really has felt very, very bad. And then the pandemic took a fucking nosedive on that front. And, you know, sometimes you talk to people and Scott, I can't tell you how like people that I respect in my professional capacity, people in the wine world who are just completely unaware of like massive tectonic events that are going on in our country and worldwide. It's truly distressing to me that even people I consider to be like thoughtful and right thinking people just have no idea, either because they don't care or because they have decided they don't have the bandwidth for it.
Or they just don't have the bandwidth for it. Something I'm increasingly sympathetic to is like people who say, oh, I don't want to hear about the news because it's all bad news and I don't want to hear about it. Like, no, fuck you. Like, you don't get to just opt out of being a person who lives on the planet. But like, not deciding you don't have the bandwidth, but just not having the bandwidth. Like, if you have a job and you have a family, then like, you have already those things plus the insane amount of data and opinion and media that we're all being bombarded with at all times. Like, how can anyone keep up with everything? You can't.
It's true.
You can't keep up with everything. And I think it's by design. It's the design of the Matrix, right? They're giving us too much noise. They're pumping too much shit into our ears so we don't look behind the curtain. Sorry, I know this is your corner here, but I'm not going to damn somebody for not knowing about all the shit that's going on in the world. I don't know about all the shit that's going on in the world. I'm oblivious to most of what's happening.
What I'm not trying, it did sound like I was trying to damn those people.
And it would be in character.
And it would be in character, but that's not what I was trying to do. What I was trying to do was more akin to what you just said, which is like the climate, the figurative climate, not the literal climate,
right,
is such that we have bandwidth problems.
Right.
Coming into our heads.
Ain't got enough. Right?
Like there's too much shit going on. And so many of us are just in survival mode. So as a result of that, there are bad actors just running amok. And I hate it.
Yeah.
And it causes me stress on the daily.
Yeah.
And for sure, I need to reduce my own news intake for my mental health, but I still haven't. And that's on me.
Yeah.
And as far as the nuclear apocalypse is concerned, like if you add that on to those two things, it doesn't seem like a quantitative difference to me, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it feels like we're facing doom on several levels all at once. I'll say on the nuclear apocalypse front, as recently as a few weeks ago, when we recorded our episode discussing Dr. Strangelove, like I ranked nuclear war pretty low on the list of things that are giving me, you know, the heebie-jeebies right now.
If you bring up the Ukraine right now,
Jamie,
I'm going to scream.
What other thought does any right-thinking person have when like Putin, who is, you know, fucking the bullet farmer in a tux, essentially, is out there agitating for war and amassing sources on the coast. And then Joe Biden has to come out and he's like, well, you know, if Putin goes and invades, I think he's really going to regret it. Like, oh my, they're just so excited. They're all, it's Buck Turchinson. They're all just hard for war. And so, yes, as of the last few days, nuclear war is rising in the ranks of things that I'm worried about.
A moment of silence for our mental health.
Indeed, indeed. What to steer us back maybe a little bit on track and away from, you know, abstract terror and specific terror in the form of this movie. The reason that for me that this movie had to end the miniseries, well, one, I think it's interesting that the end of the world has changed over the course of this franchise.
Yeah.
Like in the first Mad Max, society was beginning to collapse and there were like references to oil wars, but it was basically like a recognizable civilization, but with crazy like street gangs and fucking fascist cops.
And that's a reflection of like the supply issues that were going on in the 70s.
Right.
Specifically around oil.
Yeah. But so, and then the Road Warrior, like the opening prologue, they've completely reset the stakes and the voiceover explains that there'd been a great nuclear war over oil and the planet is now a barren wasteland and now society has completely collapsed, right? And then the world continues in Thunderdome. It's basically the same movie, but it does introduce more and more of these, like, it's the first one that introduces a warlord-dominated society with the Thunderdome area that Tina Turner controls. And then in this one, the big change is that in the intervening like 25 years, George Miller became very vocal and rightfully terrified about climate change. Like those Happy Feet movies are pretty intense, in particular the first one about like ecological collapse. And so now it's not just a nuclear wasteland in the Mad Max world that killed the Earth. Now it's also that the climate was basically being killed. We killed the planet before the nukes even started.
Right.
And so that's that plus nuclear war and the scarcity of oil and resources and catastrophic death. And it just sets this perfect stage for heavy metal, high octane, savage feudalism. Jamie, what frightens me most about this movie now, and I will say I have never experienced this before in, I think, the 10 times I've seen Mad Max Fury Road, But just watching it the other day, the thing that we've talked about this before, the thing that always made this movie feel more mythic to me is the idea that somehow this is still the same Max Rockatansky from the first three movies, but the world of Immortan Joe and Furiosa and this like insane culture that has built up feels like it took several generations to get there, right?
Yeah.
And now, Jamie, after the last 2 to, let's say, maybe also 6 years, depending on how far back we want to drag this. But like in the last several years, the idea that people could adjust to new, terrible, catastrophic circumstances and completely reshape their world and their lives to like just try and survive, to like you're saying, like limit their bandwidth, tune it out, and just to persevere, that feels extremely, extremely plausible to me that it could all happen in a generation.
After we get done recording, I'm going to need a good long cry.
Well, that's okay. I mean, so will I, because I'm going to have to drink and talk about Sherry soon. but yeah, that's it for me. It's all of the end of the world scenarios that we're facing. They're all extremely plausible. And the movie makes me feel like it could all happen within our lifetimes. Like,
and likely will.
We're not going to be like strapping on leather and getting out there in souped up cars, but you know, the idea of a complete collapse and then demented fucking authoritarian demagogue assholes want to come out and create a brand for themselves and then put it right in front of their dick so that you have to look at their dick all the time when you worship them because you're just heaven for fucking bid. You give me some water, you piece of shit. Like that all feels so plausible to me. Can I ask you something? And this is something that occurred to me the other day. It's in some of those scenes, like when, like after the, I don't even know what they're called, the spiky guys, the guys that are covered in spikes who like have canyon that Furiosa
has. The buzzards.
The buzzards.
Yeah.
So the buzzard guys, after they blow up the bridge and they kind of block Immortan Joe's guys for a while, and you get like a bit of like Immortan Joe and the bullet farmer and the people eater just like kind of hanging out.
Yeah.
And just like sitting around and waiting, or like they're waiting later on, you know, when the movie just reverses and everybody goes back from whence they came. But just like watching them sitting there and the way they kind of interact and kind of like needle each other a little bit. Like, what do you think a fucking like poker game between those guys would be like? Or like they essentially run their own little city state fiefdoms. Like, do they have diplomatic functions? Like, does the people leader host a state dinner once in a while and invites over like Immortan Joe? Like, do they call up Tina Turner from Thunderdome and have her and Master Blaster show up too? Like, I had this vision of like dogs playing poker, but instead it's all of the Mad Max warlords, the ones who are still alive at the end of their movies. But then also you got to put in like Mel Gibson and like S&M gear with like a swastika tattooed on his forehead. And then that's how you include Mel.
Jesus Christ. You would imagine that they have some kind of social contact. They're warlords, right? They have afforded themselves luxury. The suite that is behind a bank vault that Immortan Joe has for his wives is like quite beautiful. For sure, the three of them get together and drink every once in a while, and maybe they fucking play poker. Who knows?
So here's my question, Jamie. What do you think they drink? What do they drink to ride eternal on the Fury Road? It's like, obviously they've got Aqua Cola and they've got Mother's Milk, but like, is there alcohol in the Mad Max future? What do you think they're drinking?
Well, I mean, all of the produce that gets shown in this movie is just green.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you don't see any fruit, and there's only one tree. I don't have any idea what any of these people are eating, let alone fermenting.
Yeah, does anyone eat in the entire movie?
Well, no, they don't. And they hint at this produce, but it's just like, looks like lettuce or kale or whatever. It's like green vegetables, and that's cool. That's great. But like the only thing that gets eaten in this movie is a lizard.
Oh, right. Max.
By Max.
He sucks the head off a two-headed lizard. Oh, this is the best movie. It's so good.
So I don't know. Maybe they mash lizards up, ferment them, and then distill that. It's lizard brandy.
Irradiated two-headed lizard brandy.
Yes.
Well, I would drink that, Jamie. If we have so to ride eternal on the road to Valhalla in the future, let's get together.
And we'll make some lizard brandy. Actually, that would be just a fun label to stick onto a bottle.
Lizard brandy, and you just put up the picture of the two-headed lizards.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh my God. All right. It is time, Scott. It's time for the bad reviews game.
All right. So I don't like this already.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just
I know
putting it out there.
Because we're already in a headspace where we're talking about the end of the world and how it's plausible and, you know, how is Immortan Joe.
I mean, he is, but Immortan Joe is just better at his job.
That way, way better at his job. Yeah. Way smarter, way more astute. So anyway, Scott's real upset because it's bad reviews time. Mm. Bad reviews is the game where Scott has to listen to negative user reviews from the internet and decide whether they're about the movie or the wine, all while clinging to his last shreds of sanity.
That is correct. I'm okay with that today, though, because I feel like you've been hard-pressed to find any negative reviews of Mad Max Fury Road.
I got enough.
All right.
First review. Good, but not as good as we hoped for the hype. Maybe a little harsher than we like.
Ooh, that's good, Jamie. That's a good pick because that could be the movie or this wine. Because I would say this Oloroso is a little harsh.
It's a little harsh. This movie's a little harsh.
Yeah, the movie has a lot of hype, though. Is it the movie? It's the movie.
This is the wine.
What? There's hype around this wine?
There is hype.
Okay. I mean, I guess I should anticipate. There's hype.
2 stars, Vivino. T.W. Taylor was not about it.
T.W. Taylor thought it was overhyped and too harsh.
Next up, we've got, I think the redacted dropped acid before they redacted this redacted.
I think the director dropped acid before they directed this movie.
I mean, it is about the movie. You are correct. But okay. I think the screenwriters dropped acid before they wrote this pathetic script.
Wow. I mean, so this has to be someone complaining about dialogue, right? When you hear most people complain about how bad the screenplay is, usually what they're telling you is, I didn't like the dialogue, which is like, I guess that's fair in this movie because there's not that much and not all of it is terribly, I mean, it's all important because there's so little of it, but like, I mean, I guess you could say the script is bad or you could look at it and say, wow, look at this flawlessly structured movie where character and theme and narrative are all beautifully interwoven and balanced for 8 characters to have satisfying resolved arcs that all plays beautifully over the course of a car chase. Like, fuck you, the script is bad for this movie.
Yes, I concur.
Internet.
The internet is a bad place. It's a very bad place. All right. Next review. Next review is translated from Norwegian. It's 2 words. It washes.
It washes.
And I swear to God, I tried to look for Norwegian colloquialisms.
Uh-huh.
This doesn't exist. I don't understand what this person is even saying.
I am going to require you to read that to me in the original Norwegian, please.
Den vosker.
That sounded pretty good. Is that the wine? The wine is washing away your palate?
It's the wine. It was the only 1-star review on Vivino that was like more than just a rating. And I was like, this is kind of funny.
It washes.
Yep.
It and washes. Lastly, well, hang on. Do you think that this wine washes?
I don't think that this wine washes. No, I think that if I used this wine to wash anything, that thing would be dirty.
Yeah. I can just imagine like Charlize Theron dipping her fingers in this glass of this wine and just rubbing it on her forehead like axle grease to give herself some war paint. Jamie, it looks like motor oil. It looks like motor oil. It doesn't have the body of motor oil, but it straight up looks like, you know, 10W30.
That is correct. Yes. And I love it. And I love it for, I love that you gave me the imagery of Charlize Theron wiping her face with this sherry as though it was motor oil.
And then immediately being like, oh, it burns my eyes. It smells bad.
It smells great, Scott.
It does smell really good.
Right? Okay. Next one. 97% certified fresh. Yeah, redacted could have been better.
Well, that's the movie because certified fresh is the Rotten Tomato meter branding.
That is correct. That's JS 1-star on Rotten Tomatoes and did not go on to say anything further.
That's it. They're just mad at Rotten Tomatoes.
Yep.
I mean, Rotten Tomatoes is a problem, but this person is the reason Rotten Tomatoes is a problem.
Yes.
You know, somebody who looks at a number and says, oh, therefore 95% of people will like this movie. And if I don't like it, then all of these people are wrong. Like, no, man, it's just a reflection of somebody's personal taste and opinion. And the number is a lie. The aggregator is a lie. Sorry, I hate Rotten Tomatoes.
I know you do.
It's a problem.
I have 1 honorable mention this week, and it's about the wine, so it's not going to make you super upset.
Dishonorable mention, Jamie. They're dishonorable mentions, I've decided.
It's true. This is Matthias Hetland in his two-star Vivino review says, Christmas is a distant memory, so now starting the warm-up for January. And I thought that was pretty funny.
I'm sorry, what? What did he say?
Christmas is a distant memory, so now starting the warm-up for January.
Wow.
See what he did there?
That's super bad. That's bad. Really bad. Was this a one-star review?
Oh, here it is. January. It's actually a 3.5 star review. Warm up for January. Had hoped for a bit more from this. Not the best example from the Lustau Almathanista range. Plenty of minerality and acidity, but slightly lacking the fruit and spice to match it. Big oxidative character on the nose. Walnut, raisin, orange juice, milk, chocolate, black pepper aromas. Palate creates the impression of Seville marmalade without the sugar. Some cinnamon, vanilla, and a saline finish stood up to a cheese board very well.
That's a pretty good review. That feels legitimate and thoughtful. But you just like the part where he said January.
Yep, that's correct.
That's hard to disagree with. All right, well, that's bad reviews. I don't feel so distressed by it. Although, I mean, you know, just in general, I find this game trying. I find it exhausting and draining.
This will likely be the last bad reviews game.
What?
The final bad reviews game. Wow. I'm working on something else.
Oh, I had bad a good reviews idea for something.
Actually. Very much does not fit into our next planned miniseries. Spoilers.
I mean, it would. You would not have any. I mean, I guess there is enough,
but it would get very tiresome by the end.
Yeah, it would. All right, well, that's it. That's it for bad reviews. Hey, Jamie, you know what is great though is good reviews, which I'm a big fan of. And we
love good reviews.
We do, especially of our show, and we have new ones. We have new ones for the first time in a while. The desert of reviews is over, and we have found this beautiful oasis of reviews. And I would like you to share one of them with the listeners.
Before I share it, I just want to, you know, say thank you for at the end of the year and the very beginning of this one, giving us some love and some new reviews. It feels good. It feels validating.
It does. And it helps us out too. It lets people know that, hey, maybe this is a thing that's worth doing. And it, I don't know, somehow tells the algorithm that people should listen to this. And algorithm, rankings, the charts, it helps with the charts.
It sure does. So just before the end of 2021, username Sushi Bentley left us a lovely 5-star review. Love this podcast. Great content. I will recommend this to my friends and family. Keep it up. 2 exclamation points.
Aww.
Thank you so much, Sushi Bentley.
Thank you so much, Sushi Bentley. And also, thanks for saying it's great content because, you know, Jamie and I are here toiling away in the content mines all day and night, and it's brutal being in the content mines, but I'm glad to know that the content is great.
We spend all day toiling.
All day.
All day. Every day. With our picks mining this stuff out of the earth.
Yeah. Metaphorically, with our keyboards and not actually doing any physical labor.
Sitting down in desk chairs.
I'm sitting in a theater seat right now. Thank you very much. Don't tell people what kind of chair I'm sitting in. All right. Well, I think, I don't know, Jim Jam. I don't know about you. I feel like that wraps it up for ye old discussion of goddamn Mad Max, goddamn Fury Road.
Or Mad Max Fury fucking Road.
There's any number of ways you could insert more profanity into the title. Strange that there's not any profanity in the movie. Huh?
No, there isn't. I mean,
I don't think there is. And yet it is an extremely R-rated movie. Huh. Never thought that.
Sometimes you don't need profanity.
It's true.
Most of those times, you and me are not involved.
Right.
We like our profanity.
We cannot help from swearing all the time.
All the fucking time. Thank you, everyone out there in the world, for joining us.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for giving us your reviews and your attention. If you haven't already, please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have questions, concerns, email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com and make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, maybe tell a friend.
Tell a friend. Organic growth, baby. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison Rubin. That is him.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
All right. Good night, folks. We'll see you all in 1 week and we'll talk about fucking Sherry. who killed the world, Jamie? Who killed the world?
It was us. We did it.
It was us. It was you and me. We killed the world. Mm-hmm. It was our content.
World-ending content.
Daddy made you some content, everybody.